Hello and welcome to Behind the News. My name is Doug Henwood. Two segments today. We'll hear from Behind the News regular Vijay Prashad on the global ramifications of Russia's invasion of Ukraine. And then the environmental economist and activist Charlie Komonoff, who spent much of the 1970s and 80s writing and testifying against nuclear power, explains why we shouldn't be shutting our nuclear plants now. Russia's invasion of Ukraine is miserably brutal, but much of the world isn't joining the U.S.-led campaign to isolate and punish the invader. What is this crisis doing to realign global hierarchies of power? Are sanctions restoring U.S. global preeminence, which had been slipping, or are they accelerating the slippage? Here's Vijay Prashad, director of Tricontinental, a global people's think tank, to reflect on these questions. The interview opens with some questions about a column Vijay wrote for Globetrotter, a syndication service for which he is the chief correspondent, on a heating up of Japanese-Russian tensions. About 19 minutes into the interview, Vijay talks about restarting the BRICS process. The term and the process have lost a lot of the prominence they had in the first decade of this century. Coined in 2001 by a Goldman Sachs money manager, Jim O'Neill, the acronym BRIC was made up of the first letters of four countries who were allegedly forming a new power bloc in the world: Brazil, Russia, India, and China. Diplomats from those four countries began meeting to work out some common interests. South Africa joined the group in 2010, and an S was added to the BRIC to become BRICS. The idea would be that the alliance, which was never exactly rock solid, would be the nucleus of an alternative to the U.S.-dominated international order. Okay, here's Vijay Prashad. As if the world doesn't have enough trouble, the Japanese government looks to be mad at the Russians, as everyone else seems to be. There's a leak of an official document. Tell us the story of what the document is and what the leak reveals.
Well, it's interesting because every April, I mean, most foreign ministries do this. Every April, the Japanese foreign ministry releases what they called a diplomatic blue book. It's a guide, you know, for diplomats around the world, Japanese diplomats. They consult the blue book to see what's the foreign ministry's position on this or that or the other issue. And, you know, this blue book is released as a PDF online, so it's available to everybody, not just Japanese diplomats. Well, the blue book for 2022 was leaked to Kyodo News, which is a news outlet. They got to have a look at it, and they published a pretty oblique story, if I'm honest, saying, well, it looks like the blue book for 2022 is going to use the phrase illegal occupation to refer to four islands. These are the Kuril Islands north of Hokkaido in Japan. Well, who's the illegal occupant of them? Well, it's Russia. And if indeed the final version of the blue book, which should be released in the last week of April, contains that phrase, there'll be a bit of a diplomatic problem. It looks to me, however, and I spoke to a former minister in Japan, looks to me that the leak to Kyodo News, the fact that this minister was willing to speak even if he wouldn't go on the record, suggests to me that there's a kind of pressure campaign on the government of Prime Minister Fumio Kishida not to actually use that language in the blue book. Not to, because, Doug, here's the real thing. Japan, like Germany, like many other countries, India, these countries understand that the world is a contradictory place. It's not a morality play. And they have to live with the contradictions. The United States is pretending that the war in Ukraine is a kind of morality play, you know, line up behind this side or that side, good, bad, and so on. But many of these other countries say, well, hang on a second, things are much more complicated than that for us.
It does seem like it's a minority of the countries of the world that have signed on to the anti-Russian campaign, have signed on to the sanctions and all the denunciations. What's the lineup look like?
Well, it's interesting. I mean, I would say that even the sign-up to the sanctions is complicated. Japan is, after all, a member of the group of seven countries. These are the countries that see themselves as the executive of the whole planet: United States, Canada, Britain, Italy, France, Germany, and Japan. So Japan signed up to the Group of Seven denunciation of Russia's invasion of Ukraine. Japan also went ahead and they froze the assets of three Russian banks. One of them, VEB, is a major bank. Then when the European Union went ahead and pushed for the sanctioning or the cutting off of seven major Russian banks from the SWIFT system, these included the three banks that Japan had already frozen their assets, which, you know, were in a Japanese territory. Japan went along with the G7 statement. Japan went along with throwing away seven Russian banks from the SWIFT system. But at the same time, the Prime Minister, very careful not to go too far, because he went to the Diet, which is the name of the parliament in Japan, and he informed the Diet. He said, well, listen, we're going along with the United States and the European Union's project of trying to cut Russia off from parts of the world economy. But on the other hand, we are not willing to stop buying liquefied natural gas from Russia. We are not willing to end our project of massive investments in the Sakhalin 1 and Sakhalin 2 energy projects in Russia. So, as I said, world is a very complicated place, and these countries are, in a sense, riding the contradictions rather than, as it were, you know, putting on their makeup, going on stage and pretending to be angels.
That's quite an act. But Japan gets a good deal on the Russian hydrocarbons.
That's another interesting thing, Doug, and looking at just the percentages, and, you know, all of this is publicly available material. If you spend a day and look at the International Energy Association or one of the other organizations that maintains data on energy imports, exports, and the energy system in the world, you find something interesting. Japan actually imports about 88% of its energy. In that sense, it's a totally energy-dependent country. It imports most of its fossil fuels, which are a large part of its energy, especially now after the catastrophe at Fukushima Daiichi, when the nuclear plant was hit by the great cyclone and had to be decommissioned effectively. That put real fear of nuclear power in Japan. Now, of course, Japan is the only country to have experienced the virulence of nuclear bombardment with the bombs dropped on Hiroshima and Nagasaki. So there's a real sense of foreboding, you know, and Fukushima Daiichi was really quite a shock to the system. So Japan relies not on nuclear, but on importing hydrocarbons, fossil fuels. The bulk of the coal it imports is from Australia. The bulk of the crude natural gas it gets is from the Gulf, from Saudi Arabia, United Arab Emirates, and so on. A small part comes from Russia, 6 to 8% on each of these, you know, coal, hydrocarbons of different kinds, oil and natural gas come from Russia. Well, 6 to 8%, except there's two important advantages. Number one, this is the proximity. I mean, Sakhalin Island is literally 20 miles north of Hokkaido. So even though it's liquefied natural gas, there's talk in Japan of building some kind of underwater pipeline. I'm not sure how feasible that'll be, but there's talk of that. There's also massive Japanese investments in the Atlantic reserves that Russia has. So there's an expectation of increasing purchases from Russia. But actually the proximate point is that if you look at the energy market right now, not only is Russian energy, Russian natural gas and crude oil much lower than the market price, the spot price from Russia is much lower, but also Russia is actually willing to give discounts to countries like India and Japan if they continue to buy their natural gas and their crude. That discount saves a country like Japan estimated roughly 15 to 25 billion a year. That's quite a lot of money. Japanese not willing to forgo it. So yeah, they're not entirely dependent on Russian hydrocarbons, but they rely on it in a sense. And also, actually, there's a lot of Japanese government investment through their major sovereign wealth fund and so on in the Russian hydrocarbon industry, which they've seen for years as as potentially extremely profitable and has earned them in recent years very good profits. So Japan understands the contradictions. They don't have any fantasy of being able to isolate themselves from Russia. And it's not from a position of weakness, Doug, because remember, in 1905, Japan defeated the Tsar's armies, the largest land army on the planet at the time. But more than defeated the land army, which they did defeat in Port Arthur, they actually defeated, crushed both of the fleets of the Tsar's forces, the Pacific fleet and the fleet that was there in the Baltic Sea, which came around the Cape of Good Hope to relieve the Pacific fleet. Both were destroyed by Japan. Japan has had a cottage industry in the last period of films and movies and so on about that war. So it's not from a position of, say, psychological weakness that they are not willing to contest the Russians. It's actually from a pragmatic standpoint.
These islands, are they of any strategic significance, or is it just a matter of pride on both sides?
Islands are interesting, and nobody knows this better than the Chinese, who have been, well, I don't know exactly how to put it. Shall we say they've been creating islands in the South China Sea? That's how the United States has been saying they're building artificial islands. You see, the further out to sea that you have an island, the more you can extend your nation's territorial waters. That's just a matter of an international treaty. So many miles off from your last territory is where your territorial waters starts and ends. So the very fact that the Russians have control over the Kuril Islands allows them to extend their territorial waters much into the Pacific. That's a benefit for Russia because they can claim, say, natural gas fields that might be found in that region. There is talk of that. They can prevent other ships from entering, for instance, the Sea of Okhotsk, which is relatively now encased by Russian territorial claims. I don't mean the land, I mean now the sea. So there are some advantages. It should also be said that in 1956, when the USSR then, it was the Soviet Union, and Japan signed an agreement, they actually didn't exactly have a treaty on these islands or on much else. I've been asking people in Japan about this. This is interesting. You know, of course, Japan and the USSR signed the Treaty of San Francisco that ended World War II, but a lot of outstanding claims. There were claims on these islands, which the USSR had captured and held. But in the 1956 agreement, the declaration, it was said, the USSR conceded that when they do create a full peace treaty, when that is completed, then some of the islands will be handed back. The Hibomai and Shikotan Island will be handed back to Japan. Well, they've not handed it back because there's been no treaty. So for that reason, it remains in a kind of limbo. But I wouldn't say that just because they are small islands, they are not important. They are important from a military hydrocarbon exploration. And of course, as you just said, it is to some extent a matter of pride.
I'm speaking with Vijay Prashad, director of the Tricontinental. Okay, let's shift the conversation a bit to the current reconfiguration of global politics. There are people who are saying that Russia's invasion of Ukraine has made this world a much more multipolar place. Others are saying that the invasion and particularly the U.S. and NATO response to it are reinforcing the old NATO hierarchy with the U.S. on top. How do you see it? What's happening with this balance of power globally?
There's no doubt that we are in a very different situation. Things are shifting about a little bit. First, I'd just like to say I want to hold to that point that this is not a time of certainty. This is a time of great contradiction. This is a time of, I think, requires some humility and analysis at least. Don't know what other word to use than contradiction, but certainly our reaction to those contradictions should be some measure of humility. We don't exactly know where they are going. Take the case of India and Germany. These are two good examples. I've already laid out a little bit the contradictions for Japan. Germany was asked by the United States to stop importing natural gas from Russia about I think they say around 40% of German needs are fulfilled through this import coming in through the Nord Stream pipelines and other pipelines as well. Okay, well, Olaf Scholz, the new Chancellor of Germany, no friend of Russia. In fact, the current government, the so-called green, blue, whatever government they have there, is more to Angela Merkel's right. And Angela Merkel was the Christian democratic person. This government is quite hawkish on a lot of things. The Greens in Germany are very hawkish. They are not Greens, meaning peaceniks. They are Greens of a different kind. Anyway, Olaf Scholz reacted to Biden's statement that Germany should ban the natural gas by saying, no, if we did that, we'd plunge into a recession we can't anticipate. We don't know what would happen, what the level of that recession. I mean, people will lose basic power. Fertilizer industry in Germany will be very badly damaged because it relies on these imports coming from the pipelines and so on. So that was interesting. This was Olaf Scholz telling Biden this during Biden's tour of Brussels and Poland. You know, this is when Biden went to the royal castle in Warsaw and said, got to get rid of this guy, meaning Putin, which horrified many people thinking, oh God, here we go again. We thought Trump used to just slip up and say whatever he wanted. Here's Biden announcing regime change, or at least the plan. Things were so bad with that statement that even Kamala Harris had to apparently say, no, no, actually we don't mean that. But anyway, it was during that blustery tour of Biden that Scholz had to pour a glass of cold water on all that testosterone and say, listen, we can't cut off the natural gas. It's very complicated. It's contradictory. India, very interesting. India is basically a subordinate ally of the United States on so many issues. A member with Japan, with Australia of the Quad, which was basically set up to encircle China. After 2008, when the U.S. defense policy changed from prosecuting a war on terror, the policy from about 2001 till 2018, the Trump administration switched the defense or security posture to one of making sure that this is now James Mattis's language, the defense minister at the time, Mattis said that we have to now focus our attention to prevent two near rivals or near peers, was his exact phrase, near peers from coming to dominance. That's Russia and China. India has been a real participant in that with the Quad and so on. Nonetheless, during this conflict, we've seen something interesting. India hasn't gone along with the United States. Now, this last week, four people visited Delhi to try to convince India to get on one pony or the other. Well, who are these four? One, a minor official in the U.S. State Department, Diljit Singh, went there to basically wag his finger in the face of Indian officials. These are all right-wing officials. They don't take kindly to finger wagging, especially by the United States. Liberals tolerate it a little more because liberals are like that. But right-wing people don't like to have fingers wagged in their face. There was a lot of anger in India around this from the right. People were saying this is rank hypocrisy and so on. Anyway, that was Diljit Singh. Coming alongside him was Liz Truss, the foreign minister from Britain. She also got on a British Airways flight, landed in Delhi, also did a little bit of finger wagging, but she was a little more sophisticated, as the British sometimes are. None of that seemed to work. Then there were two other guests in India. One was Sergey Lavrov, the Russian foreign minister. His plane landed at the military base in Palam, in the center of India. He was greeted by the foreign minister. He was permitted to give a public press conference, Doug. That's very significant, where he laid out the Russian view on the war in Ukraine. Given the kind of suffocation of Russian media in the West and, you know, being thrown off YouTube and so on, it's significant. The Indian said, yeah, go ahead. You know, you take your time at the press conference, say whatever you want. That's what happened. He also met the Prime Minister of India, Narendra Modi. This is going to be significant in a minute when I tell you about the fourth guest. But at any rate, in that meeting, They discussed India's position and so on. Now, people are speculating, why is India dancing, in this way when it should, by all rights, as a subordinate ally of the United States, condemn the Russian invasion? Well, some people speculate 60% of Indian armaments are bought from Russia. I don't think that's the real issue. Others speculate it has to do with the oil and the natural gas. Yeah, that's true. Like Japan, about 6 to 7% of India's energy is imported from Russia. But again, it's at that discounted price. So hard to say no to that. But I don't even think that's the reason. Because after all, Japan imports the same amount of natural gas. And the Russians didn't mind that the Japanese signed up the G7 statement, EU statement. India hasn't done any of that. One of the speculations, which I think is quite credible, is that the foreign ministry section in India and that security apparatus has been actually fantasizing that this is the moment for India and others to restart the BRICS dynamic. Cyril Ramaphosa in South Africa has been pretty solid on this war. You know, the South African position is pretty clear-cut, calling for negotiation, ceasefire, and so on. They don't want to cheerlead for the war or cheerlead for Western ambitions. So I think the Indians are watching that. The fourth visitor in Delhi was Wang Yi, the foreign minister of China. Now, unlike with Sergei Lavrov, he was not given a meeting with Mr. Modi. He was told directly that you can't meet Modi until India and China settle the border dispute. In fact, Modi has apparently sent a message to China saying, I'm not coming to China until the border dispute is settled. Nonetheless, Wang Yi met the foreign minister, he met the national security advisor, they talked for a long time, but he didn't do a public news conference. That's also significant. What I'm trying to get at is that these countries seem to be wanting to restart something like the BRICS dynamic. Meetings had continued of the BRICS, but there was no energy in them. If Lula wins in the end of the year, it's felt that this is going to emerge again as another project. Russia, China trying to break out of their isolation, linked to India, Brazil, South Africa. That's a considerable challenge once more. But again, I don't want to exaggerate. We're not in a multipolar world. You know, the United States can still bomb any country and so on. But new things are happening. I mean, it's hard to de-dollarize. You know that better than anybody. But there's a lot of talk about that in these countries.
Well, yeah, I think it's going to take a long time for that to happen. But it does seem like we're taking steps in that direction. It's not quite clear how large they are, but there are steps being taken in that direction away from the dollar, which would be quite a challenge to American imperial power. About that, what do you think of the Chinese? How are they going to play this crisis? What do you think their long-term intentions are?
Well, the key phrase you just used, Doug, is long-term. Very rare to meet anybody in China or to read Chinese documents that are short-termist. You know, they don't think in the five-year plan like the Soviets. 5 years for them is nothing. Of course, 5 years is an eternity in U.S. politics, where the cycle is every 2 years because there's an election. Politicians are permanently campaigning in the U.S. The Soviet Union, it was, well, you at least got 5 years. The Chinese think in a much longer sequence. And I think you can detect, at least in the early period of the Russian invasion, in late February into early March, there was frustration coming from the Chinese foreign ministry because they didn't want this. You know, they understood the Russian position. They didn't see this war about as a war on Ukraine. They saw this war as a war about security. Whether you consider that to be a paranoid view of the world or not is not important to me. I'm merely saying that they understood that once the United States abandoned the Intermediate Nuclear Forces Treaty, that was again Trump in 2018, went into force in 2019, meaning the withdrawal went into force. After that, there has been a consistent worry in Beijing that the United States will place intermediate missiles in Taiwan, a kind of Cuban missile crisis for the 21st century. And in a way, I think Putin had indicated this, Doug, if you remember, before Trump even came to power, in the 2007 Munich Security Conference, that's the first time Putin, hardly a radical in any respect, but that's the first time Putin takes to the world stage in public. And he attacks the idea of unipolarity. He says at the Munich conference, 2007, he says, you know, there should be, we should live in a planet without one single master. Now, of course, he doesn't name the master, but, you know, you'd have to be a Martian not to know who he's talking about. He was roundly attacked for that speech. It surprised a lot of people because, you know, before this speech in Munich, he had been considered to be a kind of pliable guy. You know, you may remember Thomas Friedman had written an article in the New York Times called Rootin' for Putin. He was a great fan of Mr. Putin. Tony Blair, you know, went to the Hermitage with Sherry Blair to hang out with the Putins.
Oh, yeah, Bush looked in his eyes and gazed into his soul or something.
That's right. Yeah. I mean, you know, Putin was supposed to be the bridge between Russia and the West that Yeltsin couldn't be because Yeltsin was too much of a boozer. And Yeltsin basically, you know, was the guy responsible for dismantling the social wealth of Russia, you know, allowing the billionaires to park their money. Oh, wait a minute, not directly in Western banks. This is sometimes misunderstanding. If you look at the FDI out of Russia, and it's curious to call it FDI because it's basically piracy of one kind or the other, they parked their money in places like Cyprus, not in London. Of course, they bought real estate in London. They bought football teams in Britain and so on. But they parked their money in places like Cyprus, a little less public attention and scrutiny. But yeah, you know, Mr. Putin, he goes after the West from 2007 onwards. And in each of these kind of big statements he makes, whether it's the Munich speech or when he starts the St. Petersburg Forum and the speeches he makes there, he keeps talking about security guarantees. And I think in the Western press, this is somehow misunderstood to merely mean no eastward expansion of NATO. I mean, you've got to remember in 2004, NATO absorbed 7 Eastern European countries, including the 3 Baltic states, 2 of whom border Russia. The Russians at the time, and by the way, at the time, Putin was the president and Sergei Lavrov was the foreign minister. So it's not like a different regime. They didn't have any problem with NATO appearing at the border of Russia. Their problem escalates when Trump leaves the Intermediate Nuclear Forces Treaty, because then they start to actually fear that these medium-range missiles will be placed near the Russian border, which will have a flight time to Moscow of 6 to 10 minutes, you know, and without the ability to counter that. So when he kept talking about security guarantees, for God's sake, he's not asking, you know, Petro Poroshenko, the previous president of Ukraine, or, you know, Vladimir Zelensky for security guarantees. That's ridiculous. He was talking directly to Washington. Of course, there's a kind of cynicism in the coverage. You know, people laugh and say, you know, what security guarantees? I just want to say one last thing about this. Again, after Stalin died in 1953, the new government in the USSR, the government of Khrushchev, actually applied to join NATO. That's a historical fact that, you know, is not there very much. But they actually applied to join NATO. And in fact, after the Soviet Union collapsed, in 1994, 3 years into first the Commonwealth of Independent States, then Russia, Russia becomes a part of NATO's Partnership for Peace initiative and was in that position till 2014, till Russia annexed Crimea. So this issue of, I think it's exaggeration, eastern expansion of NATO, that itself is not the problem. The problem is Russia, after the world financial crisis, I feel, felt that integration into Europe, proper Russian integration into Europe, integration with the United States was not going to be possible. And they began to cast their lot in Eurasia. And I think that was when the die was cast.
That was Vijay Prashad, director of the Tricontinental, a global people's think tank. My name is Doug Henwood, and the program is Behind the News. Back after a musical break. That was some of Matrixed by the DJ and sound artist Bergsonist from her new album #C2FF86, which is the hex code for the electric green of the album cover, which my color app tells me is called Midori. Next, nukes. Last year, New York State shut down Indian Point, a nuclear power installation north of New York City, after over 40 years of generating electricity. Germany is shutting down its nukes, and California is planning to shut down Diablo Canyon over the next several years. Is this a good idea? After all, the electricity they will no longer generate will be replaced by power generated by fossil fuels. My next guest, Charlie Komenoff, who describes himself as a free-ranging policy analyst and activist who works in a bunch of different arenas from urban transportation to electric power to climate, was a long-standing opponent of nuclear power. He spent a good bit of the 1970s and 80s serving as an expert witness against it. Now he's had something of a change of heart, which he announced in an article posted on the Nation's website earlier this week. Here he is with more. Charlie Komenoff. There seems to be a solid consensus among environmentalists and people on the left more generally that nuclear power is very, very bad and must be brought to an end. You're having reservations about shutting down nuclear power plants as they've been doing in Germany and as we did in New York with Indian Point, right? What's the problem?
Well, you're right. I do have serious problems with it. I'm actually regretful that I didn't speak up more loudly before Indian Point was shut down, which took place over the past 2 years. And I say that despite being a champion of the green alternatives of wind farms and solar arrays and energy efficiency and believing or wanting to believe that those are the future and can power the earth. But it's not just a question of the slow pace of taking up those alternatives and filling the breach that results from shutting perfectly functional nuclear power plants. There's a sort of deeper systemic issue that I think hardly anybody has grasped about closing nuclear power plants. And that was the new twist to the article I had yesterday in The Nation magazine.
What's the downside of shutting these things?
Well, it's simply this, that these nuclear power plants, which, by the way, 30, 40 years ago, they operated very inconsistently and haltingly. You know, in the 70s, nuclear power plants achieved an average operability or capacity factor of only about 60%. And that actually went down further after the 1979 Three Mile Island accident because of all the so-called safety checks and retrofits. But in the past 2.5 decades or so, there's been a huge turnaround. And the remaining nuclear power plants in the United States, and there's about 90 or 95 reactors still, they operate on average at 85 or even 90% capacity factor. The Indian Point plants in the 2 decades before they were closed averaged in the high 80s. The Diablo Canyon twin reactor complex in California, which I wrote about yesterday, has averaged a little over 90% since 2001. And the reason that's significant is that these nuclear power plants, the ones already built and operating, provide enormous climate benefit by virtue of avoiding the need to run fossil fuel plants to make equivalent electricity. And when we shut down a nuclear plant that is providing a huge climate benefit, it means that the next green power wave, the next tranche of wind and solar and energy efficiency, which we've been counting on to further push out more fossil fuels, it doesn't really do that, this new tranche of green power, because it's having to stand in for the climate benefit that the nuclear plant was providing before we shut it down.
Why did they shut Indian Point? Was it just too old or?
No, not at all. I mean, look, the shutdown advocates were, you know, a kind of maybe three or four forces that coalesced. There was Riverkeeper, which began existence in the 60s is the Hudson River Fishermen's Association, and did a terrific job back then in protecting the Hudson River, you know, from more and more power plants and development and cleaning it up. So it's, you know, a pretty vibrant fishery. And they felt, you know, with some justification, that the continued operation of a huge nuclear complex on the Hudson River, drawing in all that, you know, Hudson River water for cooling, wasn't good for aquatic life. And that's certainly true. And then, you know, there are the accident warriors who view everything nuclear power as, quote, an accident waiting to happen, who fretted that you couldn't safely evacuate a 40-mile or 30-mile radius, which is a little bit absurd because the needed evacuation distance would be much smaller. So there were those. There were the champions of, you know, renewable energy who got high on the idea that you could have, you know, huge infusions of new wind and solar, and so you wouldn't really miss the climate contribution from the nukes. And then you had Governor Andrew Cuomo, who wanted to placate the environmentalists and was cutting a deal to subsidize upstate nukes while helping to broker the shutdown of this supposedly ill-sited Indian Point plant tucked in the northwest corner of Westchester County. So all those forces came together. But you know who wasn't at the table, Doug? It was climate. Climate was not represented in the negotiations.
What's the carbon impact been of shutting Indian Point?
We only have to look at the 21% increase in the amount of electricity made statewide in New York now as compared to 2 or 3 years ago before Indian Point was shut down, a 21% increase in fossil fuel generated electricity statewide, directly attributable to not having Indian Point anymore. It's not because of growth in electricity use, because electricity use has pretty much flatlined here and all around the country in the last decade and a half. It is strictly the result of shutting Indian Point. And that's a disaster when we need to be every year cutting back on fossil fuel power generation in New York State and everywhere else by, you know, 5, 7, 8% for a couple of decades until we have a zero carbon grid.
When you talk about nuclear power, people always come up with the same objections. One is the risk. Chernobyl, of course, that's, you could say that's Soviet technology, but then there's Fukushima, Three Mile Island going way back, but that was ancient history now. But then also waste and geologic faults, Diablo Canyon, notably, on a fault line. What's your response to those standard objections?
You know, you did mention Three Mile Island, and at the time of that mishap, you know, which was a mess and a big release of radiation, but those who call it a catastrophe are certainly exaggerating in terms of the actual amount of radiation that was released. You know, at the time that Three Mile Island melted down 43 years ago, there had been maybe 150 reactor years of operation accumulated by all nukes in the United States. And now that number is 4,000 or 5,000. In other words, we've had 30 times as much experience operating nukes since Three Mile Island as we did up until then. And there hasn't been anything remotely as scary or consequential as the Three Mile Island accident. So that's one point. Diablo Canyon in California, yep, it's on a fault. At least it's, you know, 100 or more feet above the Pacific Ocean, so you're not going to have a tsunami of the type that disabled Fukushima. Pacific Gas and Electric, which built and owns Diablo Canyon, they had to spend hundreds of millions. It probably actually came to at least $1 billion in unexpected capital expenditures to shore up the seismic supports in the plant that would ensure, or supposedly ensure, that pipes didn't rupture and electrical cables weren't broken in the event of an earthquake. And I know a little bit about that because I was a witness for the state of California, a consumer agency whose mission it was to defend ratepayers against having to compensate the company through higher rates for all of those costs. And we won a partial victory in that. But I'm a little bit familiar with the lengths that PG&E had to go to. Now, the fact that you go to great measures to prevent something disastrous doesn't mean that you necessarily succeed. But there's quite a lot of protection built in there. And to my mind, The fact that Diablo Canyon, as I said, for 20 years has run pretty much uninterruptedly for a nuclear power plant to average 90% capacity factor, and considering that you have to take it down every 18 months for a month or so to refuel it, that is not simply because the regulators have their heads in the sand. It's because the plant is operating very well. Last, the fact that every year there's another 30 tons of spent fuel rods generated by running nuclear plants, and so it adds to the cumulative burden from that plant and all the other plants in the United States. I mean, that's really not that decisive a factor when you consider the millions of tons of carbon dioxide that are avoided year in and year out because Diablo Canyon and other nukes in the United States are keeping fossil fuels in the ground. And it's not that nukes are the only things that keep fossil fuels in the ground. Windmills do, bicycling does instead of driving, energy efficiency does, solar does, but nukes are doing a huge part. And to turn them off when they're running perfectly well is, to my mind, a form of carbon suicide that I think is just insane.
I'm speaking with the environmental economist and activist Charlie Komenoff. Now, also, objections people raise, well, we could accomplish the same just with conservation.
Absolutely.
Waste less, use less. But is that up to the task? That couldn't possibly replace all the nuclear plants that are running in the U.S. now, could it?
Well, but even if it could, Doug, we need the conservation to shut out fossil fuels. And it can't do that to the extent that it's also having to stand in for the carbon benefit from running the nukes. It would be, it's a shell game. And it's something that in some ways even the pro-nuclear people don't quite grasp it, because maybe they're too used to thinking as engineers and not as economists. So, you know, you're not going to find a whole lot of people who've spent 50 years of their life the way that I have, pushing and engineering and cost benefiting and analyzing and promoting energy efficiency and conservation and renewables as much as I have. But I'm here to tell you that we need all of that plus still operating the nukes if we're going to come even close to the climate goals that we have to achieve in order to limit global temperature change to 1.5 degrees Celsius.
France's electricity zone is entirely nuclear, right?
75-80%, so that's close.
What's their record look like? Have they had any troubles?
You know, if I had to say yes or no, the answer is no. The bloom is a little bit off the rose because, you know, in the 90s, they kind of lost their way, the French nuclear program, in part because they didn't have to build any more or very much more, you know, because they had already electrified most of the French grid for most hours of the year. And so they kind of got stuck in a little bit of that situation that the United States was in of just, you know, building a handful of plants. And so the costs couldn't be of design, you know, couldn't be spread over a large enough base. They went with bigger and bigger models, which was just stupid. So, you know, France is not really quite the model of nuclear efficiency now that it appeared it was going to be, you know, 30 or 40 years ago. But on the whole, you have to give them an A-, which is pretty good.
People are talking now a lot about electric cars, and I know as a car hater from way back, how do you feel about this enthusiasm for electric cars? But, you know, if we have a nuclear grid, a nuclear power grid, there'll be very little carbon impact. So I think people might look to nukes to charge electric cars, and that will solve a lot of problems. How do you feel about that?
Well, remember, you know, the grid can be and is going to be lower and lesser carbon through a lot of means, including solar and wind. You know, so nukes are not the only way to do it. And, you know, if we're talking about building new capacity, you know, new non-carbon capacity, and yeah, we need a lot of it. You know, there's a pretty interesting competition to be had among wind, solar, and nuclear. And, you know, I don't want to come off just because I'm pretty adamant that it's nuts to shut down existing nukes. That does not translate into believing, because I don't, you know, that nuclear power has an inside track on what we should be building going forward. But, you know, your point about electrifying, about decarbonizing the grid is a key one. You probably know that in December of 2021, the city council here in New York passed, and the mayor signed a bill that pretty soon is going to outlaw the heating of new buildings in New York City with natural gas or other fossil fuels as a way to electrify heating, and it's also going to apply to cooking, you know, sort of before long. And now those same groups, as we talk, are in Albany, or the forces that got that passed in New York City, they are in Albany right now trying to pass a statewide version of the same legislation. It's a very good idea, but I'm here to tell you, because I've looked at the numbers, that those advocates are badly overstating the rate at which the New York State grid is going to be able to decarbonize going forward. And they don't know it, and they don't want to know it.
The Ukraine crisis has certainly jacked up energy prices and brought Europe's use of Russian gas to the forefront here. Germany has been shutting its nuclear plants, right? What does this do to the crisis?
Germany began, you'll recall, and your listeners may as well, that after the 1986 Chernobyl disaster, a lot of the radiation went west instead of east, and it floated over Sweden and Germany. And so that kind of led to the demise of the long-term expansion of Germany's nuclear power industry. And then after Fukushima in 2011, a deal was brokered, and I don't know that Angela Merkel, the chancellor, was a big fan of it, but she went along with it, to speed the phase out of the German nuclear power fleet that up until then had been providing as much as a third of all the electricity in Germany. And now that 33% share is down, I think, just to the high single digits. I did a calculation the other day suggesting that about a quarter of the natural gas that Germany is importing from Russia is directly attributable to the shrinkage of the nuclear contribution to Germany's electric grid. And that, of course, is both helping to fill the Kremlin with German cash and hamstringing the ability of the European Union to completely cut off imports of gas from Russia. I don't know to what extent, if any, Germany is reconsidering those shutdowns. But, you know, those shutdowns are not easily reversed. And coming back closer to home, I'm led to understand that any week now, the Indian Point reactor vessels, the heart of the nuclear enterprise, are going to be sheared open as part of the decommissioning of the plant. So here, you know, in New York, if there's any thought to possibly reviving and restarting the Indian Point reactors, that would have to get engineered, you know, politically right away.
Which means it's not going to happen. And what's going to happen with Diablo Canyon in California?
Well, the deal there, which is eerily similar to the deal that shut down Indian Point here in New York, envisions shutting down the Diablo Canyon reactors 2 and 3 years from that. So there is time to slow that down. And I will say, Doug, that my article in The Nation grew out of a letter that I sent to California Governor Newsom in February, urging him to intervene and stop that shutdown process. And my letter, in turn, was sparked by a letter sent to California Governor Newsom on February 1 by 79 pretty distinguished Californians, mostly academics, mostly a lot of climate scientists, including Jim Hansen and Stephen Chu, the Nobel laureate, former U.S. DOE secretary under Obama, appealing to Governor Newsom to stop the shutdown of Diablo Canyon. So there is time there, but, you know, I'm 3,000 miles away. That's not kind of my battle. And so I can't say, I have no inside info on whether that's a real possibility.
We should underscore the fact that you spent many years as an expert witness against nuclear power. This is not a position that you came to lightly or easily, is it?
You're right, Doug. I didn't. And for a long time, I kind of, as I thought about it, as a really climate concerned person, you know, and thinking deep down, this is a mistake. This is not good to be shutting down these functioning nuclear power plants. I hid behind a convenient rationalization, which was, that if only the nuclear industry people, the owners and operators and backers of nuclear power, well, why don't you guys support a carbon tax? And that would monetize for you in the nuclear industry the carbon reduction value that nuclear power provides. And it would make it much more difficult for a New York Governor Cuomo or a California Governor Newsom or anybody anywhere else in the United States to even think about brokering a deal to shut down existing nukes, because their financial, their pure hard cash value would become so much greater because you would have monetized the carbon benefit. And I kind of hid behind that rationalization. And a couple of years ago, I confronted myself. Actually, an opponent of the shutdown of Indian Point confronted me, made me think about it. I wrote an article a couple of years ago decrying the process that had led to the shutdown of Indian Point, but I didn't go all the way. And I guess I went all the way yesterday in that article in The Nation. And I didn't use the term, you know, climate vandalism or carbon suicide. But the article is pretty unequivocal. I think it's a really bad idea to be shutting down these reactors.
So in sum, while you wouldn't necessarily want to build more of them, we shouldn't shut down the ones we have.
Exactly right.
That was Charlie Komanoff, an environmental and transportation analyst based in New York. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. Let's go with this, some of Radioaktivität, the German version of the Kraftwerk song known in English as Radioactivity. Till next week, bye. Good.